2 years of genocide in Gaza. Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW. Building a more compassionate world, one broadcast at a time.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Peace, 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 and welcome to The Collision, where sports and politics collide. I'm Etan Thomas, joined by my great co-host, Chuck Modiano. Dave is not here, but he's going to be back next week. But Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Etan. How about yourself?
I'm good. I'm over here low-key hating, low-key a little bit jealous because you were front and center at the in Vegas,
yes,
watching the Aces in Fever Game 5. Ooh. It was a great game. I was watching it on TV, but you was live in person. Tell me what you saw.
Oh, it was – I'm still in Vegas. I had a pre-planned trip to Vegas, family reasons and others. And then, you know, this Game 5 just happened to show up in my lap. And when I realized Game 4 wasn't going to be a wrap, I said, I'm going to go. And I'm so glad I did. It was such a great experience. It, for those who don't know, it was a tie that went into overtime. You saw both Aja Wilson and Jackie Young just go off, 35 points, 32 points. First time ever you had two 30-point scorers in the same playoff game. Jackie Young really came to play. And I say Jackie Young because Jackie Young does not get the credit that she deserves. And you'd think a four-time All-Star and two-time champion would get that credit, but she's overlooked. And at the same time, I got to give the Fever a lot of credit. You know, there was a scary moment there, not that far from where I was sitting, where Kelsey Mitchell just sort of collapsed. It looks like she's going to be okay, but that was scary. Aaliyah Boston fouled out with a few minutes left. So without Kelsey Mitchell, without Aaliyah Boston, and of course we know Caitlin Clark and Sophie Cunningham have been injured, they kept fighting punch for punch. Odyssey Sims coming back, dropping 27. You had a fight. So I got to give Indiana Fever all the respect in the world, but it was just such an amazing experience, and I was just happy to be in Vegas at the right time.
Let me ask you this, because there's been a lot of discussion about this, and they play differently without Caitlin Clark. Now, I'm not saying that they're better off without Caitlin Clark before all of the, you know, Caitlin Clark fans blow a gasket. That's not what I'm saying. But they play different. Now, what did you see up close and personal watching the flow of the game, the offensive movement, the way that everybody else is involved? It's, you know, sometimes with Caitlin Clark, it's almost like James Harden, where she's doing her thing and everybody just standing around looking at her. You know what I mean? And sometimes she makes it, sometimes she misses it. That's what I see. But tell me what you see.
Well, I see something similar. I think this is the best thing that could happen to Fever and Caitlin Clark long term, depending on how Caitlin Clark comes back. Okay? Because what everyone realizes is that the Indiana Fever are loaded with talent. Loaded with talent, and people are sacrificing their games. So with Caitlin Clark out, you saw people like a point guard, like Ari McDonald, spread it around. You saw Odyssey Sims spread it around. We see the level that Kelsey Mitchell is just a flat-out all-star, arguably all WNBA backcourt, along with Alicia Gray this year. You could argue, I might even give Jackie Young a fight, but we could argue that. And then you see up front what Aaliyah Boston could do, and particularly her rebounding. She probably doesn't get enough touches like she can. And Tasha Howard could play. Sophie Cunningham off the bench was an important piece. Shot a very, very high percentage as well. And people came in and plugged in and played. So what the future holds is, what did Caitlin Clark learn, right? Because Caitlin Clark has some negatives and she has some positives. Her positive is she's a brilliant passer, and arguably I would say the greatest passer in the WNBA right now. Her court vision is ridiculous. And if she realizes that she has that and that's her greatest asset, and it says, I have all these tools and weapons around me, and I'm going to spread it out and lead the league in assists every year I play, shatter the record, get 12 assists a game, then I think you're going to win some championships. On the other hand, if Caitlin Clark comes back and gets pressure from her fans and her sponsors to do logo three, Caitlin Clark, a bad percentage shot, which is like a 30% shot. And don't call her Steph Curry. That's insult to Curry, who shot 43% from there. Now, before Steph Curry was shooting that, we called that a bad shot. Steph Curry made us change the way we think because he's dropping it from 43%. So we're like, oh, okay. Well, it's a bad shot still. So if you want to take that shot and you want to be logo three Caitlin, it's not going to be good for your team. So I really hope Caitlin learned that lesson.
I hope that a lot of the Caitlin Clark mob, now this is a specific group that I'm talking about, not WNBA fans, not WNBA fans that are fans of Caitlin Clark. The Caitlin Clark mob is a specific group. And I hope they will see, even though they probably won't admit it, that the Fever are a very talented team. And it's not just the Caitlin Clark show. And a lot of these people, especially people in the media as well, I mean, Vic Vitale, Christine Brennan, Frank Isola, we can go down the list. Yeah. But they all want to talk about the WNBA as if without Caitlin Clark, it's nothing. Well, that's not true at all. I mean, we just talk about the Fever and the fact that they were able to make it this far without Caitlin Clark shows that there are a lot of great players on the team.
Oh, absolutely. This is really the best thing that could have happened, her injury long run, to her, to the Fever themselves, chances to win a championship, and to the WNBA, and to the WNBA discourse. Because I do remember last year that mob that we've spoken many times on this show about was basically degrading the rest of the Indiana Fever team. That should, when you said, okay, she has to work on her turnovers because she shattered the turnover record, and that's a fair critique, but if you shatter a turnover record, she needs to work on that as a young player. Instead of being called hating, instead they said you're a hater. They said things like, well, the reason she has such high turnovers is her incompetent teammates can't catch her passes. I'm telling you, you've heard this. I've heard these arguments as if like that doesn't exist for every single point guard ever, some, you know, missed passes. So you started to see the denigration of the teammates. Well, that has been thrown out the window. This experiment without Caitlin has shown that talent. They can't do that anymore with any rational basis anyway.
Definitely agree. Now, let's talk about Mephisto Collier's amazing statement. The social media exploded after her statement.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was brilliant. It was eloquent. It was articulate. It was to the point. It was, you know, it was a great statement. And it's interesting to see a lot of the fallout from it. It was interesting to see Kathy's response to it. But let me tell you, tell me your reaction to everything that you heard, and especially the response.
No, I have a reaction, but you said amazing statement, so I want to hear your reaction first.
Well, I think that you can judge the reaction of the different players in the WNBA. As far as, you know, I didn't hear anybody, say what she's saying was untrue or go against her. And I think it is a great way to head into the collective bargaining because, as we've said so many times on the show, they are going to try to split them apart. It is so important for them to stick together. And I'm speaking from experience as somebody who was in the union, you know what I mean, on the executive board, lined up against David Stern and all the different governors. And I saw how the media split us apart. I saw how David Stern split us apart. I saw how he plucked out Derek Fisher and got him on their side. So when I said earlier that I can see this happening, and I said if they were going to do that with anybody in WNBA, it would be Caitlin Clark. You know what I mean? They set it all up. But the fact that now with this statement that Nafisa Collier made, she united fan bases of Angel Reese, fan bases of Caitlin Clark, fan bases of Paige, fan bases of Asia Wilson. She united all of the fan bases who they were doing a terrific job of pitting against each other. So she said, no, we're all in this together and it's us against them. And I thought it was brilliant. The timing was perfect. I can't say enough of it. Now, you tell me your thoughts.
I agree with everything you said. It was perfect. And the unity, let's understand the fallout's not coming from the WNBA players. Like you said, and I wanted your experience because you've been at those tables, it came from the outside, okay? It did not come from inside the WNBA. In fact, after the game, Aja Wilson, the MVP of the league, said, I'm riding with Fee 100%, everything she said. And she opened with those remarks before taking questions. She opened with remarks sending love to Kelsey Mitchell and wishing her a happy recovery, and then talked about Fee's statement. And then you had people on the Indiana Fever, Lexi Hall, who said, I agree with every single thing Fee said. You had former MVPs, Elena Deldon, who's retired, agree. Washington Mystics, 2019 champions, by the way, agree with what Fee said and said, critiqued Engelbert and saying there's something human missing from this league and how I was treated. When I retired, I got a call from everyone but Kathy Engelbert. So what Fee said, and she said a lot, she covered a lot of ground, but she talked about the inhumanity of the league. Everyone was in agreement. There was an incredible unity. And I think part of that unity comes from the percentage we talked about many times, 9%, that the revenue sharing is 9% that goes to the players. And from Fee's statements, we heard that people, including Caitlin Clark, should just be happy that they're getting a salary, you're happy that they're getting sponsorships and endorsements. Just be happy to be here because we provided the platform. So we find the WNBA leadership sounds a whole lot like the NBA, NFL, MLB, and every other leadership in big-time sport.
I definitely agree. You know, let's take a break because I want to ask you about this person who I wasn't really familiar with. His name is Dan Dukakis or something like that.
Yeah.
And he represents a large majority of the Caitlin Clark mob. And when I reference the Caitlin Clark mob, a lot of people are saying, oh, were you saying all white WNBA fans? No, that's not what I'm saying. And they say, oh, well, all Caitlin Clark fans. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about a specific group of fans. I wouldn't even call themselves really fans, but they're trying to weaponize Caitlin Clark. And right now, after she got injured, they were upset because they could no longer weaponize her until next season. They don't care about her injury. They don't care about her health. They don't care about anything like that. Just that they could no longer weaponize her. So let's go to this quick break, and we'll be right back with more of the Collision, the Sports and Politics Collide.
In the league, and you all think that it's great. Really? the league officiating is terrible, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I didn't hear any, none, zero, zip, was getting knocked around. I didn't hear any of the bit anybody else when the angry lesbians were beating the living crap out of Caitlin Clark on a nightly, almost game-by-game basis. All of a sudden now, oh, it's affecting you, and now you got your ass beat. Little Collier or whatever your name is, and now the officiating's bad. Now we're going to rat out personal conversations. Now it's the league's fault. This is typical. These women are the worst. They are the worst, and you all are buying into it. Pay attention a little bit, would ya?
Yeah, so that's Dan Dukakis, and I'm not really familiar with him, but I want to go to your reaction, but let me just say this real quick, Dan. Okay, Fee is actually standing up for all WNBA players, including Caitlin Clark. That's the part you're missing. This is including Caitlin Clark. You want to separate her and you want to weaponize her like that Caitlin Clark mob that we keep talking about want to do, and you're only focused on, you don't care about anything about any of the other WNBA players, just how you can use Caitlin Clark, even though she has repeatedly said, do not use her that way. Do not use her for hate, bigotry, racism, and y'all care about anything about that. We're going to keep on using you, and so this is indicative of the Caitlin Clark mob that we reference. Again, you know, a lot of people say, I see a lot of the comments, oh, what are you saying, the all white fans are you know, for Caitlin Clark fans that we're all part of it. No, that's not what I'm saying. Listen, these people right here, and if you don't fall into the category of these people right here, then I'm not talking to you. Okay, but Chuck, go ahead. Your response to Dan Dukakis.
Well, you know, I hate responding to him, and I feel bad, you know, Dave Zirin, we just learned, has debated him in the past. So my condolences. I mean, I feel bad for Dave that he had to go through that, because on some level, there's a part of me is like, let's not talk about this dude. Let's not talk about this guy. And then on another level, he's useful to talk about because this mob is real. I'll put it at 50% of Caitlin Clark fans. And what I've always said is that 50% who came from Caitlin Clark, who came for her greatness, and they stayed, good for them. We still broke some new records without Caitlin Clark playing this year. But the 50% who just came for her whiteness, they can stay back. They can go home. Now, what was clear from his remarks is that he doesn't know who that Nafisa Collier girl. Nafisa Collier is new to him. So he clearly doesn't watch the NBA. And because he clearly doesn't watch the NBA, and I'm skipping over a lot of racist and sexist remarks, you know, I don't want to give him too much shine. He was going in there. But he hasn't watched the NBA, and it's indicative because he works for OutKick. And we know OutKick is like the gutter, white male sports bastion, racist, sexist segment of the sports media industry, along with the bar stools and whatnot. And they have an audience. And that audience has ignored the WNBA up till Caitlin Clark's arrival, and apparently he's still ignoring the WNBA. So he already doesn't know what he's talking about. And even within him confessing he doesn't know what he's talking about because he doesn't watch and doesn't know who the best players are, he would know that her statement was so much broader than fouls on Caitlin Clark, which we've discussed many times here. And the reaction to those fouls on Caitlin Clark, but not on black players, is almost always white men. Almost always comes from white men, from the OutKick crowd, from the Barstool crowd, who are protective of Caitlin Clark in a way that they're not protective of the black women players, and not protective even of white male players. I've never seen them get all messed up over a white male player. So there's something about a white woman specifically that's triggering to them. And he should also know that, you know, Nafisa Collier, I'm just going to say my opinion. I watched Game 5 last year with the Liberty. I believe the Minnesota Lynx fairly won that championship. I did not agree with the call on Breon Stewart, that they gave her a ticky-tack call. And if maybe she didn't go on rants, but you can't tell me Nafisa Collier doesn't know and feel that a championship was stolen, because I feel it. And I watched the replay many times. So we're talking about a person who's A, I feel has a championship stolen from her. B, is the vice president of the WNBPA. Maybe Dan doesn't know that part. And then C, is obviously feeling a certain way after her injury. And I'm more charitable. I don't believe it was anything dirty or anything like that, as some have said. I believe it's just a freak, horrible thing that happened. But when you add all of those things together, you could understand where Nafisa Collier is coming from. And for her to use her privilege, because she's like kind of a beloved player, and risking that being taken away, she gets a lot of credit for that as well. So, and I think she was the perfect person. And she said in her remarks, I have to use my position to speak, you know? And, you know, one thing I've always loved about you in your playing days before I knew you is that you, you know, you used your position as an NBA player. And at the same time, you know, had a, I don't want to get into that space, but had a, let's say, an MVP level player had done it, it maybe would have even more of an impact. And what Fee is an MVP level player and risks that. So I have to give that respect to any WNBA player, but especially to her.
Oh, 100%. And the fact that he kept saying, like, he didn't know her. I mean, she was the...
Collier girl.
Yes. Yeah, like, I'm like, wait a minute.
Collier girl.
There's a case to be made that she could have been co-MVP this year and last year. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's like, didn't know anything about her. And it's just interesting how this group, and it's not just a white player that they want to wrap their arms around. You know, I wrote this article a long time ago about why that mob, the Caitlin Clark mob, doesn't wrap their arms around Paige the same way. Paige is phenomenal. She was phenomenal in college. But then you also have, you know, Breonna Stewart, Kelsey Plum, you know, Sabrina Ionescu. You know, you got a lot of different white players that are really good players in the WNBA. But that Caitlin Clark mob, they don't celebrate them. They don't weaponize them. They just picked Caitlin Clark as the chosen one to do that.
It
all started from that game in college when Angel Reese beat her. And she did this, and she told her about herself, and she did this, and then she was the instant villain. And that's so they had the racial dynamic to be able to build, and they're not going to let it go. Like, as much like Caitlin Clark can make as many statements as she wants to, please do not do this, please do not, you know, weaponize me. Don't you? It's bigger than Caitlin Clark now, and it's always been bigger than Caitlin Clark because they don't really care about her. Like, even when you saw the injury, and she, Caitlin Clark came out, and she tried to play. It was like right before the All-Star game. She didn't look good. She looked like she was injured still.
Yeah.
She was like, God, they should have immediately, if they really cared about her, been screaming that she is not healthy. Get her off the court. Rest her. She's a franchise player. You have to treat her with respect and dignity and all that. They didn't say that. No. You didn't hear any of that from any of these Outkick, all these, you know, Barstool people. So even when she got injured and wasn't able to play for the playoffs, they were mad again. Not because they didn't take it, okay, well, that's good. You know, it seemed like they were going to RG3 her. Seemed like they were going to throw her out there and have her, you know, hobbling around because so they could market her. Seemed like, you know, right after you have Tyrese Halliburton, who played in the game and now he's injured and can't play for the whole season. It seemed like they did not care about that at all. No. All they cared about was her being on the court so they can weaponize her. And you got it. You got to expose these people for who they are. They are not there for the right reasons. Now, my issue with the WNBA is I felt, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, they knew that. They knew that racist, bigot, like a crowd was coming to support. And they really kind of, I'm not going to say they opened it, they welcomed it with open arms, but they didn't really do what they could have to really stand against it. You know, they made a statement every now and then, you know, the WNBA does not stand for racism, bigotry, and put out a statement. But they didn't really, you know, make it plain that that was not welcome the way they could have. Do you agree with that, or is that an unfair statement?
Not only do I agree with it, if I disagree, I disagree the other way. I would say the WNBA came to the mob with open arms. And the ESPN came to the mob with open arms, because anytime there was a hard foul, that if we saw it on any of the black women, I posted video of Aja Wilson getting just mauled and punched in the face, or Angel Reese, who Alyssa Thomas sort of just pulled down in her first game, harder than any Caitlin foul, more close to an injury than any Caitlin foul, and they said nothing. So if it was about hard play, I would have heard about it when it happened to black star players. The truth is, if you're going to come into the WNBA and you're going to be a star level player, you're going to get some extra attention, and Caitlin's going to get some extra attention too. But what the WNBA did is they started showing these fouls, leading with ESPN would lead with them and talk about it like it's a controversy. The Chicago Tribune editorial said there should be criminal charges on Kennedy Carter, who's not in the league, and I'm not going to dismiss that these things are related either. There was a different reaction. And what I've heard from some people, I think they make the mistake of saying this is Magic versus Bird 2.0. And while there are elements to it, I never remember Larry Bird getting fouled hard and all these white men losing their mind over it. There's something about a white woman element, specific and unique to a white male reaction to a white woman, that almost echoes decades of lynchings when you really want to get into it, a sort of virtual reaction of what those lynchings might have been back in the day. And they're losing their mind, and they have, they're protective of Caitlin on being fouled. Not a fierce athlete that she is. Not treating her that way. Not even treating her how they treat white men. So if we want to get to the root of the problem, we have to understand why this mob is reacting to this way, but not reacting to that way when a black woman gets fouled the same way. Let's have that conversation, Atan.
Well, let's go into it a little bit, because today is actually 225 years ago today, Nat Turner was born.
Oh,
and right, nice. And so Nat Turner is he led the largest slave revolt, Southampton County, Virginia, and from that time on, you know, even before then, but from that time on, especially, there was this white fear.
Yeah,
what are these people who we've done so wrong going to do to us? And there was this white damsel in distress. When they made The Birth of a Nation, that encapsulated all of white people's feelings at that time as far as the need for a KKK, the need for a protection of the white race, protection of white women, because all these black men, because we was raping their women for all this time and we were brutalizing them and lynching them, now they're going to want to do the same thing to us, so we have to protect our white women. And that's when that was really birthed. So it's a direct correlation to how they're using Caitlin Clark and the description of her, like the white damsel in distress.
That's right.
She's this white delicate flower. We have to protect. You heard Dan Dukakis say about how these black lesbians were attacking her.
Lesbians. That's what he said.
And use these different terms. And it's just they're drawing on a historical white fear of black people because of what they did to us. And that line, that correlation needs to be made more, because it's so deliberate. And and that's why a lot of times people say, well, why do you keep talking about people like Jason Whitlock? Because it's worse when you see a black face echoing those sentiments for me. Yeah. It's worse. You know what I mean? Right. There's certain things that you expect from, you know, the Outkick crowd, from this cat, Dan Dukakis, and all of them people. But for a black face to do that, it's racial treason. You know what I mean? It's worse than just having blackface on and tap dancing. He's literally committing racial treason.
Well, he's committing racial treason, but then there's this other element. It's a hustle, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's Whitlock, and I used to write columns against Whitlock years ago that infuriated, and then I just stopped altogether because, you know, for some people, it's just a hustle. Like, this is, I'm not saying they don't believe some of that, but they realize they could get more clicks. They realize they could get more money. Outkick has that hustle in general. Yeah, Whitlock has that hustle in general. And at some point, Trump has that. You know, Trump has had that hustle. And at some point, you have to get to a point where you realize, when am I actually helping them, right? When am I being reactionary helping them? And that is the hardest decision to make. And I say that as someone who's, like, covered protests against Nazis. Like, when am I amplifying and helping, and when am I not? When do you critique, and when do you not? And it's very tricky. And because I'm of the belief that the mainstream media elected Donald Trump because he polled at 1% before a mainstream media picked up on him. And then he went to a press conference and said, you know, Mexicans are rapists and all these other things. And they started giving him all this attention. And I'm not just talking about Fox. I'm talking about MSNBC and CNN, all the others. And at the time, the head of CBS, I hope I'm saying his last name correctly, Les Moonves, had a very revealing statement. And he said, you know, Donald Trump might not be good for America, but he's damn good for CBS. Mm-hmm. And what Trump did and what the media did, whether they liked him or not, is they had a deal. I'm going to say it is some crazy bigoted stuff. You're going to amplify it. You're going to get higher ratings and more money for amplifying me, even if you hate me. And then I'm going to rise and I'm going to get more attention. So there's this dynamic, and you have to sort of figure out when is it right. And I thought about it even, you know, do we discuss, Dan? I do believe there is an element that we have to understand that while the WNBA is unified, it's this white male crowd that is trying to start this division. And I think it's useful. I think there are times we got to pass. But what I do believe, and I think we're in agreement on, is that I don't think a lot of people in sports understand the social ramification of Caitlin Clark, and that I fear her. And we've had conversations about, like, I fear the reaction to her. And I say that in a way that the right wing really understands how to utilize popular culture. Okay. And that popular culture, we've seen how they've weaponized Charlie Kirk in crazy ways. And they were doing the same thing with Caitlin Clark. And we have to be very mindful about that to prevent that, but not promote that.
Goodness gracious. You're absolutely right. You know, we're at the bottom of the hour, so let's go to a break. But let me just say this. It's terrible that racism sells, bigotry and hatred sells. And it's not just the person. It's not just Trump saying this. It's not just Charlie Kirk saying this. It's all the people that support them. You know what I mean? And that's the part that people have to understand, that if they were speaking to an empty room and nobody supported them, they wouldn't continue saying it. If Jason Whitlock didn't, you know, rise up by doing what he's doing, he wouldn't keep doing it. Then that's the bigger problem. But let's go to a quick break. We're going to come back with a great guest, Ms. Pamela Smith. I'm very, very excited to talk to her. I was very triggered by this video that I saw, and I have a lot of respect for what she does. So let's go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of The Collision where sports and politics collide.
Happy birthday to you. You live in the zoo. You look like a monkey.
Hi, Legend. Did you have a birthday last week?
Yes.
And how old are you now?
Six.
You're six? You're sure you're not 60?
I'm in six.
You're six. Can we sing happy birthday to you? Yes. All right, here we go. Would you like the funny song now that I sing to you? Okay, goes like this.
Happy birthday to you. You live in the zoo. You look like a monkey. And you smell like one, two. Woo! Give a clap, everybody.
Ooh, that was very triggering for me because I went to Catholic school when I was younger. And it brought back so many different memories. But we'll get into all of that. But I want to say thank you to our guest, Ms. Pamela Smith. She is fantastic on social media. If you're not following her, please follow her. And she's at Black Home Educators. She's really a champion for homeschooling, which you've heard me say many times on this show. Me and my wife homeschooled all three of our children leading up to high school. So she is retired on 46 acres. You know, featured in Forbes, Revolt TV, Tavis Smiley, and she really has put together a whole homeschool community And it's really amazing what she's doing. So happy to have her on today, Ms. Pamela Smith. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good. Thank you for having me.
Well, first, thank you for getting, because I know it's early where you are. We're on the East Coast and you're not. So first of all, let me thank you for even getting up early, because one of the things about homeschool, you ain't got to wake up at the crack of dawn. You can get your kids are well rested. They can get up and they can learn and they can do their work. And they don't have to waste so much time at traditional school. I can go on and on. But first, let me ask you, this video, because I saw you post about it and I posted about it as well. It was very triggering for me. But what was the part that wasn't surprising, but it was still disappointing to hear, was the number of people that were dismissing it as nothing big. Like, oh, you guys are making a little bit too much out of this. This is a song that we all sang as kids. I'm like, do y'all understand that a lot of the songs that we sang as kids were very racist, that of how they actually, started and what they actually mean and the implication? We sing them, but when you find out what they really mean, you would stop singing them. But what was your response and your reaction to seeing that viral video?
It was triggering to me also. I mean, I was out all day and I think it was a couple of days ago. And when I started checking my messages and everybody was like tagging me in the video. So I went and watched it. And the first thing I thought was, this is inappropriate, you know? And for a teacher out of all people should know that even though this is a song that people have sang, you know, back in the day or whatever, it's inappropriate to sing that to what looked to be, you know, the only Black child in that classroom. And the reason I say that is because being the only child in the class that's of color is already hard, you mm-hmm. know? So that teacher should have been even more sensitive to, you know, the things that she does and says.
Definitely. Go ahead, Chuck.
I mean, I couldn't believe the obliviousness. And I'm being generous right now, because you could read that two ways. One, either way, this teacher is just terrible. First of all, it's great to have you, Dr. Smith, on the show. What is the reaction? I see a lot of white kids in the group. What is the reaction to white children in the group and how they may be learning and perceiving as this teacher is moving down this way? I say that with, like, I was thinking of the Dr. Kenneth Clark studies in mind, of the young white kids and Black kids learn about race as early as 2 years old with the white dial test and the Black dial test. And I'm thinking, what's going on? How does this impact the group? And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. The children are learning from their environment. You know, I've said that over and over again, that whatever is being taught either in a classroom or at home, I don't believe kids are born racist. I think they learn from their environment. They learn from their parents. They learn from their teachers. And how a teacher responds or what a teacher does has an impact on not just the Black children, but also the white kids that are in there, who may in turn turn around and sing that song to some other Black children that they may encounter.
I mean, I could, you know, okay, so let me just tell you. So I went to a school called Monte Cassino in Tulsa, Oklahoma when I was younger. And I was one of three Black people in the class. And we all stuck together, me and Devin Isaac and Andrea Hatter. And we're all close still now, even today. We're all old now, but we're all close. And there are so many stories that I have of being in situations where there were things that were just inappropriate, where you're just singled out as a Black person, where a teacher will say, I remember Sister Emily, and it's even worse than that. I remember Sister Emily, a little kid had a slingshot, and Sister Emily said to the kid, you know, why did you bring that N-word shooter into school? And I was like, what the devil did she just say? You know what I mean? So we went to the principal, Mr. Thieben, and he's like, oh, she's older. She, you know, from a different time period. It's not really a big thing. I was like, no, it's a big thing to me that she just said this all casually. But there were so many different instances. You know, Sister Agatha looked at me when I went back and she said, oh, you people grow fast, don't you? And I'm like, what did she just say? You know what I mean? So I'm a little kid learning how to navigate through racism. And other white kids are seeing how, okay, they're treating him different, probably because we're better. Like, and that develops the superiority complex of white kids. That's what I saw. What is your response to that, and what do you think?
Absolutely. You lived it. I mean, you were in that environment, and you know. And that's exactly how that happens. They are learning from their parents. They're learning from their teachers. They're from their environment. And they're learning. They see how the white faculty, the white staff treats the black students. And so that plays into who they grow up to become. And they develop. I see it every single day. You know, being a content creator, it doesn't matter my background, my credentials. I still have what I would say white women who have nowhere nearly has accomplished as much as I have will still think they can come and correct me, right? Mm-hmm. They somehow are superior. And I see that every single day with them. And it is learned behavior. It is what they have grown up to believe.
Mm. Go ahead, Joe.
That's right. Well, you know what? I'm so interested in really it's homeschooling. We're at a time where all curricula is under attack. Trump has just gone full speed ahead with it. But let's be honest, even before Trump, the curricula was pretty bad as it was. When I went to school, I learned Columbus discovered America. I mean, other myths of that nature. So tell me the case of homeschooling and that decision to make homeschooling in an environment that a lot of young people are not getting in the institutions.
Well, my family and I started homeschooling about almost 18 years ago. And the reason we started homeschooling was because our children at the time were in a Christian school, you know, and we were under the impression that Christian meant, oh, well, they're going to be treated good. These people are God-loving folks. And what we started to see quickly was that wasn't the case. A lot of times people put their kids in these private schools, rich folks, doctors, lawyers, because they don't want them in public school. And the other thing I saw was my children were losing their identity. They no longer liked their 4C hair, being picked on by my daughters being picked on by white boys. And so what I saw was the children were not seeing themselves among their peers. They were not seeing themselves among the curriculum, and they were not seeing themselves among the staff, the administrators, the teachers. And I quickly saw the damage that was doing to my children. And so I decided to homeschool and take charge of their education because I did not want them being taught exactly what you said. Christopher Columbus was a great guy.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. You know, we homeschooled our children all the way up to high school. And here in PG County, you know, PG County is a special place. So we have black Christian schools, you know what I mean, that are not like what I grew up with in Monte Cassino. So my kids go to Bishop McNamara here. And it's really like a little HBCU. You know what I mean? Like the way that we would not feel comfortable sending our children there if it wasn't properly done. If education wasn't properly done. And even then, even still, you still got to be on top of stuff. And I would really encourage black parents especially to really dive in deep about what is going on in your children's school. Because, you know, black parents, you know, you're working, you don't have a lot of time, you know, you finish your homework. All right. But go a little deeper because there was so much stuff going on in some of these schools. I have a friend who just told me, and I won't say his name unless he wants me to, but a few years ago, he pulled his son out of a Catholic school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because he learned that the teacher had nicknamed him Buckwheat. And that's what they all called him. And he's like, wait a minute. You know, they were sitting around. He said it casually. Yeah, the teacher always calls me Buckwheat. That's what I was like, wait. They were like, they call you Buckwheat? What do you mean? So they had to go up there and snatch. But that stuff like that, microaggressions, things like that happen all the time in some of these private schools where there's only one or two black kids. I'm telling you. So I really salute the work that you're doing and promoting homeschool. Talk about that a little bit more and your entire setup and how you have hired different teachers and everything like that, because I think it's really phenomenal.
Yeah, the first step for parents is, if you're, you know, listening to this and you're thinking, you know, well, how in the world can I homeschool? First step would be to look at your schedule, look at, are you working from home? Can you change your shifts? What could you do? Homeschooling comes down to the ages of your children, the time that you have, you know, if you have a spouse or a partner that can help with that, because certainly that helped. My husband and I were a team over the years. So we're, you know, before we retired, we were entrepreneurs. And so I think, you know, from my approach, I always try to encourage parents, get free all the way around. Like, you know, if you can start a business, having your own business will definitely give you that more flexibility. For us being business owners meant I could bring my kids to the office with me, right? My husband and I could take turns. When he had to be in the office, I was home, vice versa. So you really have to look at your time, your schedule, and then really from there, looking at your state, because every state has different homeschooling laws, making sure that you comply with those laws. And then from there is really looking for curriculum, that fits your child. You know, the biggest mistake I think parents make is trying to repeat school at home. As you know, homeschooling is, it's about your children learning at their level, at their pace, in a comfortable environment. You know, I think the mistake a lot of parents make is the very first thing they want to repeat school at home. And that's not the purpose of that. We know that schools were designed for the industrial age. Mm-hmm. It was designed to crank out factory workers. And that's, yes, that system has not changed. And therefore, we're not producing children that have the mindset to go out and start their own business. We know the book by Carter G. Woodson, The Miseducation of the Negro. Basically, Carter G. taught us that, you know. That these schools are not teaching us how to go out and make a difference in our own communities.
Oh, 100%. And let me just add to what you're saying. You know, there's a few things. It's very important for young people to be able to get rest, especially if they're athletes. Mm-hmm. And young people are so tired in school. You know what I mean? I mean, my daughters just had a game last night and had to wake up because they're in high school now and they're so tired. And my baby girl, baby Sierra's like, man, can I go back to homeschooling for a little bit? Because she can rest. She can wake up at, you know, 10 o'clock and eat and then knock out all of her work and not waste time at school. School is a lot of wasting time, you know, going from one class to the other, line up here, go to this assembly. All that stuff ain't got nothing to do with what they're learning anything. And then also, it's so important. So even if you can't homeschool, it's so important for parents to teach their kids about their history at home. It is so important. Because if you're not taught anything about your history, anything about your culture, then you're going to grow up like almost being ashamed of what you come from, because you're only being fed these negative, you know what I mean, images of your people that are completely incorrect. So it's so important. But time is flying by. I want to ask you one quick question before I let you go. I want you to speak directly to the people who minimized what they saw in the video and said it wasn't a very big deal and that we're making too much out of something that is sung and you know, all the time when kids are little. And this, the importance of knowing what you're singing, like knowing what you're actually saying, knowing what the nursery rhyme says and what it was meant to say. You know, talk about that, because I saw you do a video about that, and it's really important for people to understand the impact of that.
Well, I think if somebody is in 2025 and they don't know what the negativity around calling Black people monkeys is, either they're intentionally, you know, ignorant, or they just really have been living under a rock. And I would say to them, they really need to take time to study history. They need to take time to listen to Black voices. You have some people that just, they know what it means and they're just trying to dismiss us. They're gaslighting, you know. But for the people that may not understand this because, you know, they haven't lived in our world and perhaps they've never called Black folks monkeys, then I would say you need to listen to Black voices. You need to listen and understand why that's negative. You know, when Barack Obama was in office for 8 years, that they called his family monkeys. We got to get those monkeys out of the White House. I was just on TikTok yesterday and a young lady posted a reply video to a white man who called her a monkey. Mm-hmm. Monkey is a common term that they use to describe our people. We know during Jim Crow and the minstrel, you know, the minstrel shows, the depiction of Black people as monkeys, the way they, you know, showed us with big lips, eating watermelon, all of that goes back to that time period. And I would say to them to take time to listen to Black voices, to read and study and to understand.
And let me say also, there's so many different examples. When a few months ago, Angel Reese was on the cover of NBA 2K, and the person, you know, transposed her image with the image of a monkey. And that's what there's a reason why that specific insult is historically used. So when people will say, oh, it's no big deal. No, it is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I will say, sometimes white people don't know. And they have to listen. Like you said, quick example. I was in college and we were in either Maui or Puerto Rico. And so we're all, you know, outside swimming. And an assistant coach, and this is my guy, you know, Bernie Fine. He was my guy. He was my big man coach. I worked with him all the time. So this is my guy. He made a statement and he said, hey, I thought Black people couldn't swim. And all the guys like nervously kind of laughed. And, you know, I remember Eric Williams, you know, kind of giggling. And, you know, we got that uncomfortable, nervous laugh. And I was like, I had never heard that before. I was like, well, why would you say that? What does that mean? And Eric Williams said, oh, because if we could swim, that means we would have swum off that boat, you know, the slavery boat. And I was like, is that what you were saying? So I looked at him and I said, okay, what if I said I thought that Jewish people didn't like showers? I was like, because, you know, Hitler would tell them they were going to take showers and then, you know, spray them all with acid. That would be a sick and twisted joke, wouldn't it?
Right.
And it was just silence for a little while. And he said, I apologize. I did not even look at it like that. That is completely my fault. And I will never make that, you know, reference again. And we have to be able to call people out on something that is inappropriate, not give an uncomfortable laugh. You know what I mean? That uncomfortable laugh where you're, and you're really, it's like stinging you. No, call them out because sometimes they don't know. Now, once you explain it to them and they disregard it, then that's different. You know what I mean? But you got to sometimes explain it to them. But we ran out of time. I love everything that you're doing. Please tell everybody where they can follow you, all the different things, how they can get in touch with you and everything that you're doing.
Hi, yes. Well, thank you for having me on the show. I love your content as well. You know, I'm always sharing it. And so I definitely look up to you and admire you. So thank you for having me. You can find me at Black Home Educators. I have the same username on all the platforms, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. You can find me there or send me an email, Pamela@blackhomeeducators.com.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Much respect to you. Keep doing what you're doing. You're inspiring a lot of people. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Okay. For sure. That was Miss Pamela Smith, ladies and gentlemen. That was a great discussion, Chuck.
That was a great discussion. It really was. And I want to explore this homeschooling bit more. I wasn't even fully aware about you and your kids the whole way. So that's an important discussion. And then there's another discussion to be had for those who can't manage to do homeschooling. What are some of the alternatives? But that's for another show.
100%. Before we go, let me just say there was a passing of you know, Lawrence Moulton. He was Syracuse great. And I'm going to talk about it. We're going to do a special, you know, on the Tom and Devo show. So we're going to do a special tribute with a lot of different guys that played with him. But it really hit you hard because he was a little bit older than me. And he just, you know, he wasn't sick, anything like that. It just, you know, it really hit me hard. So I want to say You know, my condolences to his family, you know, his friends, all the people in the DMV, because he's from here. So, you know, rest in peace, Lawrence Moten.
Rest in peace. Definitely. What a great player, yeah.
Okay, we'll be back next week with more of The Collision, the Sports and Politics Collide.
Yeah, Ghost is global, classic soulful. Teddy pinned the grass on wax with the nasty vocals. Penthouse, doorknob drawers and the floors is opal. Diamond shaped rules, the indoor pool is purple. Superb like bird and magic. A real deep thinker with silk words that's smoother than virgin fabric. And I'm two-tone gummies, I'm the first to have it. We don't f***ing bear skin rough, just Persian rabbits. We mad nice, cigar in a glass of water. Got excited.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly five decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways that you could contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need, running or not. It can do wonders for WPFW, so donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents What Breaks the Heart, joining millions around the world and marking 2 years of genocide in Gaza through interviews, stories, and poetry. The day programming will reflect the cultural and political concept of Palestinian Sumud, highlighting the enduring presence, resistance, and connection of the Palestinian people to their land. That's What Breaks the Heart, commemorating 2 years of genocide in Gaza. Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW, building a more compassionate world, one broadcast at a time.
The Can I Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back. And it's coming to Southeast DC for the first time ever. Enjoy 3 nights of martial arts and action films, scored live with hip-hop, soul, and more, mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two Tone Jones. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Gonna Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set, followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit shaolinjazz.com. shaolinjazz.com.
Part 2 of the 2025 Homeroom Music Festival is Saturday, October 4th at the Aletha Tanner Park in Effington. The celebration continues with a day of music and culture featuring Junkyard Band, Brandon Woody, plus performances showcasing Latin rhythms and African beats. The festival also brings together live DJ sets, record fair, vendors, community activities for all ages. Details at homeroommusicfestival.com.
If you're a WPFW supporter, please take a moment and record a testimonial as to why you support Jazz and Justice Radio on our testimonials hotline at 202-588-0796. Messages must be 1 minute or less. It is with your generosity that we are able to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. And we thank you.
The Birchmere presents The Whispers on October 10th and 11th, and Keiko Matsui, November 2nd. Details at birchmere.com.
WPFW has offered inspiring music, poignant stories, and critical journalism for over 48 years. Whether reminiscing while hearing Nina Simone or learning about the harm done due to gross global inequity, WPFW has been the soundtrack for moments of revelation, joy, sadness, and resistance. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. We ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our fall pledge drive by donating at WPFWFM.org and additionally